welcome to edition 399 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show this week, Survive, the band, not the life or death imperative. We'll be speaking to the Texan electronic music group about their hit soundtrack for Stranger Things, how it's changed the sounds we hear on TV, and how it's changed them too.
We'll also be talking to Tiffany Dark, journalist and former editor of the Sunday Times Star magazine, and now author. She'll be discussing her new book, Now We Are 40, which dissects what it means to be part of Generation X, a generation on.
And we'll be looking at the colourful history of the cycling jersey. Yes, we did just say that, with cycling journalist Chris Sidwells, plus the broadcaster and cycling aficionado, Matt Barbette.
All that plus a steep downhill is the news. Look ahead with Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan and some good tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oh, Tom, what a week. Have you enjoyed it?
Rob, it's been incredibly busy, but what dynamism there's been in and around.
Has it? If you
Midori
could give
House.
Out awards this week to your team, like who would be getting
I've
them?
Definitely got someone in mind who would certainly not get an award. We'll
right.
hear from him in a moment. I don't know. Well, we had a lot of live events at Midori House this
week. I think
week.
We have had, haven't we?
Always very special. The Urbanist Live on Thursday. The Menu Live, Rob, on Friday night. I'm still only just recovering from that.
Are you?
Yeah.
So what was the fibre of the fabric that they were dishing out to give you such a puce complexion
well,
of
we
a
were,
Sunday lunchtime?
We were
Tom.
Drinking to the very success of London as a food and drink centre.
Yeah.
So
there's
I
only
needed
one way to,
celebrate
that.
I had
right?
to toast that with alacrity.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. I've enjoyed it too. It's nice to come back. A little bit of dancing around. I was in a tree and I fell out of it, so I was out of my tree in Thailand. That was really fun, and it's nice to come back and not really know what day of the week it is until
that's
today,
fine,
of course, because I would not miss a Monocle
no,
Week
you
for
wouldn't.
Anything.
You did look a bit confused earlier in
no,
the week.
No, that's fine. That's just,
what were you doing exactly?
I had jet
best
lag.
Not to ask.
Jet lag.
So. Jet lag.
Yeah.
Now, anyway. You mentioned award winners.
It's already dark in there. What's going on?
It's dark
talking of
the
award
glass.
Winners, yeah.
Well, yeah, a dark pall has descended on the studio.
Mm.
And if we're talking about losers in award season, we're talking about Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry. Love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry. Love the way he takes his hop.
But how am I doing now?
I think I know why it went dark behind the glass a second ago. This is genuinely...
Hi, Henry.
A true hello.
Yeah.
An attempt at an explanation.
Okay,
Last week, during production of Monocle's, I'm not sure really how you would describe it, daily morning chat show, The 10, I...
One of the greats.
Inadvertently...
It's like Anne and Nick, isn't it, on the radio?
Precisely.
Google it, people...
I inadvertently punched the light switch mechanism.
In a jealous rage?
Behind, not in a jealous, inadvertently
oh.
punched, injuring my hand, I'm fine, thanks for asking, and breaking the light system. So that's why it looks like
it's really weird,
Pink
it,
Floyd
now?
In Pompeii behind the glass there.
Pink Floyd in Pompeii?
Have you not seen that DVD? It's quite...
No, I mean, no, I haven't.
Pick it up.
Okay.
What's happening this week around the world, Henry?
On the 27th of February, the annual traditional flower, F-L-O-U-R, war takes place in the Greek seaside village of Galaxidi, or Galaxidi, where a war is fought using coloured baking flour. The town is 200 kilometres west of Athens, should anyone want to locate it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it's become one of the most popular events in the country to mark Clean Monday.
So it's before Shrove Tuesday?
I think so.
So
and then it's Ash Wednesday,
there is
isn't it?
Lent-related.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Clean Monday, is that a thing?
Do you guys know...
I don't know.
I know
that.
Blue Monday?
I was hoping you'd be able to shed some light on that. Mm. But I was going to ask you, have either of you been involved in any genuine, spontaneous food fights in your life? Rob,
yeah.
You must have been.
Why I must am, I have
Because I imagine you being the instigator of such a war.
Yeah.
I've in a classroom
food,
environment.
Food fights.
Okay.
Definitely.
What kind of food stuff were used as missiles?
The last proper food fight I think I had was a friend of mine's 40th birthday.
Can we ask what the food stuff involved was?
Well, it was sort of beef welly, sticky toff.
Oh.
That sort of very traditional British gear that, I'll tell you what, sticks to a cornicing like no tomorrow.
I mean, that... That kind of fair
that
makes,
is not
it,
what
makes
I was thinking.
That kind
really?
Of fair makes some serious projectiles,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, like Billy-O.
Yeah, Tom?
I once got in trouble because I threw a whole baked potato at someone's head and they ducked and it struck another man on the back.
An innocent bystander?
He was. He was struck down by the potato.
When I used to
collateral
work...
Collateral potato-based damage. But a whole... But I really heaved it at this guy as well and he ducked under it.
How cooked was it? Was it...
And it was slightly overdone but just soft in the middle.
How old were you? Was this a couple of years ago in the Monocle
I was
canteen?
Old enough to know better.
Was this in... Was this at work?
It wasn't at work, okay. I must say. It takes me back to my school days, to be okay. fair. And we've all...
He brought the guy down with the potato, with a spud.
Took him out.
Spud missile.
I'd say it was a good 20 paces, and it just flew dead arrow straight.
Yeah.
A daisy cutter straight across the room in slow motion like that.
You still retrospectively pride yourself on your schoolyard athletic prowess, yeah. which is now, all vestiges of which has now faded beyond vanishing point.
That's true. We're going to be talking later about our,
yeah, we are, aren't we?
Our sort of age, middle
words.
Age.
On the 26th of February, the Tokyo Marathon is taking place in Japan. And I thought we could use this as an opportunity to talk about... Well, in fairness, I did say that all vestiges of your athleticism have disintegrated, but actually, you claim run several marathons in your time.
Have you done
the Tokyo?
I haven't done Tokyo, no.
Well, have you done any off this sept dial?
Yes, Paris.
Okay.
Have you?
One of my favourites. I highly recommend it. And I never cast the net wider than that.
Is what's good for a marathon, a hilly place or a flat place? Because
definitely, well,
flat.
I would say flat. Berlin, of course, traditionally the fastest of all the big city marathons. Yeah. A couple of absolute gems.
The fastest, why? Because
in the US,
very flat. Isn't it?
It's very flat, and the wind's behind you at relevant
points
stretches. Chicago, Boston, an amazing marathon. New York City, one I'd love to do.
Yeah. You have done the marathon, Rob? Or?
No.
Been to Tokyo?
Been to Tokyo.
There we go.
Definitely done a lot of dancing in Tokyo.
You had a few marathons in Tokyo, though. Session!
And on the 28th of February, Mardi Gras will be taking place in New Orleans. Now,
yes,
this is kind
please.
Of like...
This is my kind of thing.
This is well, yeah. I was going to ask if either of you have been, because this is kind of like the Super Bowl. It's kind of an American institution, which has formed part of, I would say, the scaffolding of my cultural awareness, just through popular culture, since I was very young. But I don't actually have a very precise understanding of the history of the event or what it entails. Maybe one of you can enlighten me. Have you ever been?
No.
So, apparently, it's also called Fat Tuesday...
So we've got Clean Monday, Fat Tuesday.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it dates back to when the French were in control of the city. Apparently the history is hazy. The parade... Now, this gets a little bit esoteric now. The parade is organised by members-only crews, spelled K-R-E-W-E-S. The most prominent being the crew of Bacchus with the biggest floats.
Whoever the arrangers are, I'm down to party there. I'd love to. I mean, New Orleans, I would love... It's one of the places that... We've hardly even written about it in the magazine in 10 years. I would love to go there. I'd love to go to the jazz festival there.
What about a big old feature?
Yeah.
Andrew Tuck, if you're listening, and I know you are, misses the show.
I would definitely run the New Orleans Marathon.
Oh, can you imagine that?
After Mardi Gras.
Henry, it's been wonderful to speak to you again this week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
The biggest TV hit of 2016 was Stranger Things, a tale of supernatural goings-on perplexing an unlikely group of teenage friends living in 1980s small-town America. Part of the Netflix show's charm, a tricky quality to bring to an often creepy, gore-splattered storyline, was created via the soundtrack, created by members of Texas band Survive.
Its pulsing analog rhythmic sounds brought both menace and a touch of nostalgia to the programme, and it's been compared to the work of synth luminaries such as John Carpenter, Giorgio Moroder, and even Vangelis. Survive are Kyle Dixon, Michael Stein, Adam Jones and Mark Donica. Three of those dudes are here today, by the way. They're here to talk about Stranger Things and their highly praised sophomore album, RR7349, which came out last year. Welcome to the programme, everybody.
It was nice to hear you, that long intro, you know, it gave us a nice break to sit back, you know, and now we're back.
Did you zone out a bit?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Wow, this is really well done.
Yeah, it was really well done.
They've really done some Google on us here.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
For the benefit of our listening several, we're going to play a little, we're going to play a bit of Copter from RR7349. By the way, the title of that, What's that? I'm getting sort of THX1349, whatever that George Lucas.
That works.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
We'll just go with that.
So it's got a sci-fi vibe to it.
Ambiguity.
Okay.
So it's the catalog number.
Okay.
So every record that you buy has a catalog number.
Yeah.
And we just chose to name our albums based on that.
We don't name our releases.
But I'm glad that you got the THX vibe. It's
in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys know what this is.
No.
So, but if you want to play instruments along with it,
feel free.
But for our listeners, okay. This is for their benefit. Okay, that was a little bit of Copter from the album RR7349.
And there was a little bit of a very brief bit of air synth that happened at the top of that. That's good to know.
Well, that was your Carl Dixon down the end there.
Yeah, sure.
When you play air instrument, do you always play it to your instrument that you play, or do you kind of do some air drumming?
Well, I pretty much only play one instrument, so it always kind of looks like I'm typing on a keyboard. Yeah.
So let's take the bull by the horns first and talk about the soundtrack to that wonderful show. What does that do for your normal music making, as we might put it?
Well, it means that we actually get to sleep in hotels every night when we travel.
Phew.
And that there's more than just the same, couple hundred of our friends at each of our shows, now we get to do cool stuff like fly to England and, more people know about us, I guess. That's the best thing about it, really. Manchester audience was adorable last night. They were just very giddy afterward.
Giddy. Yeah, yeah, they were very
excited. We signed more autographs than the rest of the tour, I'm pretty sure. And
Crowd was a bit older last night too, there were also very young people there too.
Well, I was going to ask you guys about this because we mentioned John Carpenter's Giorgio Moroder and Vangelis and this sort of, these synth titans from the past. Do you feel ever that idea that you're kind of in some kind of synth, new synth vanguard? Or I guess if there's older people there, they're fans of those artists as well. Do you feel like you're educating a new audience, or are you just doing what you've always liked doing?
I feel like a lot of the people that like us already know about all of the massive stuff that's happened. Not all of it, but most people are generally with the internet familiar with the history of giant synth bands and soundtracks.
And do you write, tell us about the writing of it. You presumably write in a different way when you know something's going to go with pitches than you write when you're writing an album that's designed to be played live or designed just to listen to on headphones. What's the kind of driving force for those two different branches of your career and your work?
Well, writing for picture, you're just supporting a story that already exists. You've got images and a storyline that you have to.
So you really are writing off a picture, off a moving image or off a still.
So it's a little bit easier. You don't have to do quite as much to hold someone's attention because they have a visual and a narrative on top of that. But writing for headphones or something, you have to do a little bit more to keep people's attention. So
I think that when we write songs, maybe we don't think of things in terms of stories as much as we'll just get a phrase or an image that can be triggered by a sound or something, We always have goofy working titles for our songs before they come out, and a lot of times they'll just be some feeling tone that we gave it when we were coming up with it, and that could be, any number of things, and then a lot of times the finished product won't even necessarily reflect that because it goes through a lot of bouncing back and forth between our own personal studios and collaborating in our practice space together and all kinds of stuff, we've been playing, especially from the first album, a lot of these songs live for a few years now, and the version that you hear live is a lot more developed and embellished than what was on the album initially. So it's
I wonder if it's that stuff that I wonder whether you are a jam band, whether these things work out of messing around a little bit, and suddenly you find a melody and you find this great structure to something that kind of presents itself over time to you when you're just hanging out doing your thing.
So I would never call us a jam band.
That's the thing, because it's a bad word. It's a dirty word, isn't it?
It is. But I think in the way that you mean, every band is a jam band because you can't just sit down and immediately play a wonderful melody. You have to mess around a little bit. In that way, I think a lot of the stuff that we come up with does come from just sitting down and messing around for a while until something sticks.
And also, I guess,
hours and hours of refining that.
And working in electronic music, there are very few jam bands in electronic music, but you've got to find your way to the great song somehow.
Yeah. Sure.
And what about sometimes it can be like just a random sound, like that could be an accident, you know, and you make just a random sound and it has a certain feeling to it. So you write a whole set of music just based around that. It's usually just some kind of spark inspirationally and then a lot of refinement.
That struck me as interesting, what you're saying, Adam, about, you know, you just something that, you know, a note that struck or a sound or a mood and maybe everyone just feels at the same time. Have you always had that? Was it one of these weird things where there was a bit of a chemistry between you guys and there would be those moments where quite early on you realised you had a shared sense of the mood of a piece of music or the mood of a certain tone? Or was that something, again, that you had to kind of craft down loads of time?
Well, one thing I would say about us that took a while for like outsiders to mention to me that I didn't really notice is, you know, a lot of our songs are kind of in halftime rhythms, you know, kind of slow tempo, but still kind of driving because we'll have tighter synth sequences going on top of it. And there's some other bands in Austin that are maybe not doing exactly what we're doing, but like also doing analog synth music. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've heard a few people talk about like, oh, it kind of sounds like some Austin stuff. And, you know, particularly some people in L.A. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And they're like, oh, all you guys in Austin do the halftime rhythm thing. And I thought that was kind of interesting because I think about it. Some of my other friends' bands, you know, it wasn't even something we talked about. We just started doing that. And we all just sort of certain core elements of the band were never discussed. We just did it naturally. So yeah, I guess we did have a chemistry in that kind of way.
We grew up sharing music and listening to music together, so it wasn't like we were coming from completely disparate areas of music. I mean, certain people like certain things more than others, but we shared a common back catalog of music, so we could reference, you know, oh, what if we did something like this for this song? And I think there was a good sense of what not to do a lot of times as well. And we definitely check each other on that, like, nope,
yeah, we're not, that will so not there was be a bit this of, song. There was kind of a shorthand, wherever it came from, whether it was around in the scene a little bit or in the music you're listening to. It just makes it easier, I guess, if there's a shorthand, you can kind of cut to the chase a bit.
And how does that work? I mean, working in Austin, the same has been said of many cities over the years, music cities over the years. They say about Nashville that if ever someone's off sick, the bus driver or someone can pick up a guitar, can pick up can play the drums or the keyboards to the extent that they can all fill in at least for a night. What's that like in Austin? Does it feel there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas or socializing in the same places?
Well, I would say that 80% of the people I know are in a band.
Yeah.
I don't know how much crossover there is directly, but I mean, I guess there must be some kind of influence over your friends and people that you know, but there's a lot of different people making different types of music, but there are certainly a very large number of musicians in Austin.
Is it quite tribal? Mark, you were going to pick up on that. Does it feel if you're making electronic music that you stick with your own? If you're making rock and roll music, you stick with your own?
I feel like it's very mixed. Like, a lot of people are going to different shows. Like, I mean, there's not, like, Austin is, like a mid-sized city, but there's not like a ton of like museums. And, I feel like one of the main things that people do like at night is go to shows. And we've played with like metal bands and like garage rock bands and all different punk bands, all different types of music is happening all the time. And like, there's just a lot to listen to. That's good. It's just not necessarily like synth music, but it's still like totally cool.
There's only two industries in Austin. There's the tech industry and music. And so
and there's food too.
Oh, food, for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, that...
and alcohol.
That's definitely an industry.
That is intermingled and married to the music industry, because almost every single musician is...
eats food.
They are like the service industry. It's a weird thing, you know, like every single restaurant you go to, everybody is going to be in a band. It's just
it's required by law there.
Yeah.
We wanted to talk to you briefly before we go about season two of Stranger Things, or rather your work for it.
Sure.
Here is the trailer, which features some more of Survive's work.
Look on my ego.
You like on my ego.
Okay, some old stuff there from Survive, who we have with us. We want to know a bit about season two, right, Tom?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, you talked earlier about, you said it's kind of an easier process writing for pictures, but I mean, does it become more difficult? Is it easier once you've kind of immersed yourself in it? I don't know, maybe now so many people kind of know about it, they have their expectations. Does that complicate the creative process at all, or does it not really change things? Let's just leave it there. That's fine.
Yes and no, I suppose. It doesn't. I don't feel like it'll be any more difficult, but there are definitely more people who care this time around. So I'll have to answer to people more, I suppose.
I'm sure they'll let you know personally. I'm sure they won't be backward in coming forward, will they?
No, indeed.
TV fans tend to be that way a little bit.
Kyle, Mark, Adam, Survive. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Well, no prizes for guessing whose music we're playing today. This is Survive with AHB. Survive there with AHB from the album RR7349, and we're finding out what happened to Generation X just after this.
Tiffany Dark will be known to many as the editor of the Sunday Times Style magazine, a post she defined over 12 years. Her latest project is a book, Now We Are 40, which looks at the generation that fell between the baby boomers and millennials, Generation X.
Those who came of age in the 80s and 90s belonged to an ambiguous era shaped largely by figures who knew exactly what Generation X wasn't, be they Kurt Cobain or Kathleen Hanna, Damien Hirst or Douglas Copeland. Now, the large majority are well-adjusted, slightly fuller figures pushing middle age. So what went right? Well, Tiffany Dark is here to tell us. She's written a book all about it, which is a fascinating thing. Is it a nostalgia trip, or is it a how to survive the aftermath?
It was basically.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi. It was a solution to my midlife crisis, actually, truth be told. But I think it's that classic thing where you sort of breach the middle of your life and you think, "What the hell am I doing here?" And the book is essentially looking back over where we've been so that we can work out where it is we're going.
I like that. You see that? Now, that does sound like the front and the back of a T-shirt as well, doesn't it? Would you wear that, Tom?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is hard-won experience we're talking about here as well. But we'll go through some of the chapters in the book. But what is the kind of leitmotif? Is there a moment, whether it be a festival, a pop song, a TV show, a person, that kind of sums up the vibe of the book? And kind of what could go right, having lived so wrong?
Maybe. I think in the course of the book, obviously I did a lot of looking back at the 90s, and I came to the conclusion that it was a very, very special decade, and that people who lived through them, as Generation X did, lived on kind of two sides of what has disrupted the world massively now, which is the sort of pre-digital and post-digital world.
Are you saying that Discman is not digital?
I actually had a Sony Walkman tape player.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm that old. Yeah, so we do remember a time, you know, I remember sending my first email. People, you know, thought computers were just for writing kind of essays on, you know, they didn't, you know, have all the functionality that they have now. But I think what's interesting is it's not a single person or a single event, but it's the path that we weave through that. And as much as I adored the 90s and think that they had so much to offer and we got a lot out of them, I was so disappointed by the noughties, actually, because from sort of 2000 to 2008, it didn't seem anything happened rather than, you know, just people binging on excess in every single way. Mm. And there wasn't really a kind of great cultural moment in the noughties.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I couldn't kind of get... I got into lots of bands and lots of stuff in the 90s that I couldn't quite get into in the noughties.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting into stuff again. I don't know why that is.
Oh, that's interesting. You see,
I didn't really like... You know, I couldn't get into an iPod, which I could get into a Walkman or a Discman. I couldn't get into downloading, get into CD.
Have we learned how to deal with the wealth of stuff at our disposal? Because I think one of the things, and you make that point quite early, is that there were still shared experiences in the 90s, whether it was the TV you grew up watching or the music you heard or even stuff you would go to. You had to go to it and it was
physically
shared.
Yes.
And the noughties was whilst the world adjusted to the fact that you could just sit and on a screen and everyone could go to it, there wasn't that same feeling of shared experience. So has it just taken us 10, 15 years to get to grips with that as a society, maybe?
I wonder if that is, I mean, you might well be right about that. I mean, at least we recognise what the issues and the problems are now. You know, everyone talks about, I'm so addicted to my smartphone. At least everyone knows that they are addicted to their smartphone. I mean, I think that there's such a mass and wealth of information and culture coming to us all the time that we don't have time to digest half of it. We don't give ourselves time to just digest half of it. And it doesn't have the time to grow organically as it used to back in the day. Mm. And actually, the book starts with the rave years. And I think rave was a really interesting point in culture because it happened very, very quickly. It kind of ripped through the country in a matter of, like, you know, maybe 1 or 2 years. There was, you know, raves were happening everywhere and house music and all of that kind of thing. And that was pre-digital. I mean, people kind of found out about it by kind of meeting in petrol stations and swapping information through car windows. And that was how it happened. But it happened very quickly. But it was a totally organic movement. And it relied on people physically going somewhere and being together and being in a community.
And I wanted to talk to you about that idea of community. I wonder if you feel that they're the same now, or whether we, at our age, looking back at them, all being Gen Xers ourselves around this table, pretty much, right? Us three. Whether we still have that feeling of community around certain records, certain TV shows. I had a very 90s experience. My first job was doing work experience, then being a runner, then being a researcher on TFI Friday.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah,
I had a very 90s experience.
Yeah.
And before we were talking about this, I was like, should I tell Tiffany about going to Zoe Ball's birthday party at the Met Bar with Chris Evans to go? And so it's in my blood. Cut me and I bleed the 90s. I mean, literally, it's unreal. So there was a great, and there was, you know, that was a great TV show that people watched before they went out to the pub and then, you know, came and watched again on the way back with kind of slightly different eyes, I guess. But there was a great community around that. Do you think that sort of thing, do you think those kind of cohesive moments work through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram, the way that people communicate now? Do you think it has that richness and subtlety, I wonder?
Well, it certainly has. It's certainly very effective. I mean, God, social media communities are, you know, embedded and dominant. But are they as positive, I wonder?
Yeah.
You know,
are those positive? Well, those shows and those moments were quite positive. They were nothing if not positive.
Yeah, they were entertaining and they were enjoyable and, you know, they were kind of provocative as well. Whereas, you know, social media can actually be very intrusive and quite damaging. And, you know, people are constantly moaning about the fact that Twitter isn't what it used to be. Facebook is just a waste of time. You hear people talk about those communities with really sort of, you know, kind of negative tones. Whereas the communities that we experienced back in the 90s, I think everyone felt very positive about.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the conversation with your, when you pitched this book, the conversation you had with your publishers and your editor, because it's a very it's a very specific thing. Just before you, we had Survive, the band, on, who have done the soundtrack for Stranger Things, which channels the 80s expertly. And we're now talking about the 90s, which that wave is breaking on the shore. You're right at the front of it. You're on the first bodyboard on that breaking wave, Tiffany. But what was that conversation like? Was it like, oh yeah, this is going to be perfect? But there is obviously a target audience. Yeah, there are sitting ducks like us dudes here who want to know all about this. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, luckily, actually, my editor, the editor or director at HarperCollins, Kate, is exactly the same age as me. So she totally got it, and she did a PhD in youth tribes. So she she was a lucky find. And actually, you know, she said to me when the book first arrived in the office, she said it was completely divisive. She put it onto the, you know, desks of people who had lived through the 90s, and they were like, yes, you know, the 40-somethings, yes, get it. And then the millennials, they were like, what is this? What is this all about? But actually, interestingly, you know, I interview Emma Gannon, who is the one of my sort of token millennials in the book. And she and I have ended up having some really interesting conversations. And I think that it is a kind of manual for millennials, because this is coming down the pipe, guys. This 40 thing is coming down for you.
They're not going to be able to cope with it. They're not as good as us.
They're healthier than us.
I actually think they'll cope with it a lot better because we don't want to grow up, whereas millennials are desperate to grow up. They're a bit like boomers. You know, they're trying to escape their youth and trying to get older and, you know, be more established and so on, whereas we're constantly trying to escape back to it. But I do think, actually, that one of the big conversations and flashpoints in society now is boomers versus millennials. I mean, they're properly angry with each other. Millennials are properly angry with boomers for nicking all the money in the houses. And boomers think that millennials are selfish and self-oriented and flimsy with a short attention span. And they just don't get each other. And I think that Generation X, we understand both of them. And I think we're a lot more sympathetic to millennials who, you know, are finally showing some, you know, get up and go and creating their own culture. And I think, you know, we understand boomers, you know, because we know the world that they have come from as well.
Tiffany, do you think we'll stay as a coherent grouping? Because it's interesting, we still talk about baby boomers, and these are people like, you know, our parents' generations who might be in their, certainly, 70s, 80s even in some cases, and they're still baby boomers. And you can identify them, and there's traits that you can see this whole group of people have. Will there be a generation
X? A lot of wine.
And it's usually very nice.
They've got big pensions.
But all these things mark them out, and they're taking their nice holidays 2-3 times a year. When we're sitting here in, I don't know, whatever that would be, 20 years' time, 25 years' time, will we be a cohesive whole?
I think we will be, because I think we will have shared experiences, and that's why I think the whole sort of science of demography is interesting. For a start, I don't think we'll have the pensions that the boomers had. We'll have to work a lot. We'll probably live longer than the boomers, so we'll have to work longer than the boomers.
I don't think we will live as long as boomers,
because of what we did in the 90s.
We got no chance, Tiffany.
Oh, yes, let's hope that doesn't come to pass. But I think the other thing about us is that we really went after careers and jobs that were our passion. I don't think that we were as motivated by money as the boomers and the millennials are, actually. And actually, a lot of us went into careers in the media and so on that were all about creativity. And we didn't really think about money, which is, you know, what's quite annoying now, because you get to this stage in your life and you're like, oh, God, I do actually need some money. And also, a lot of those media careers now pay less than they did, you know, 20 years ago, which is, you know, the disturbing thing that's happening in the digital revolution. So we will all group around the fact that we will have to find a way of supporting ourselves into old age. We'll probably, you know, most of us have ownership of some kind of property, but we'll be the last generation who can overwhelmingly say that we do that. I think there'll be lots of things that we do having. And actually, one of the things I'm rather looking forward to about being old is that I want us to all get back to our community raving days. And I want us all to go into communal homes together that we can reinvent. So it's not the retirement care home thing that there is now. But we actually have some fun, a bit like the Golden Girls, you know, just all live in flats with like-minded people and have a laugh.
Long may it last. So I like the idea that, exactly, rather than getting tip-offs for raves at the petrol station, where will we be getting it? At the sort of...
Probably some kind of clinic or something.
at the Booper.
That's fine. You can still get together.
Yeah, it's good. It's
a future plan for Booper, that, actually. Yeah.
It is quite good,
isn't
it?
Yeah, maybe that's where you'll be working.
Maybe that's where I'll be working.
And there's good. Some head good, of branding. Some good wedge in that as well, yeah, exactly.
I'll be on the hospital radio.
It'll mean something very different then.
Yeah, exactly. Tiffany Dark, congratulations on it's such a great idea for a book. It looks handsome in its sort of its knowing Acid House cover. It's called Now We Are 40, Whatever Happened to Generation X, complete with a very nice quote from Doug Copeland on the back, we might say.
Oh yes, I do have to just give a quick plug to Doug. He is amazing, and actually the book was named after his novel, yeah, obviously, which came out in 1991, Generation X, which identified us and which I just thought at the time was an absolutely brilliant novel, and went back and reread it, and it's really worth a
reread. It's better now than it was before, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still very relevant, but actually I must recommend also his latest book, Bit Rot, which is a collection of his essays and journalism, and I think he's got the most whip-smart mind, I really do, and he also writes fantastic short story fiction, which is in the book as well. So if you're looking for a really good bedside table dip in, dip out read after my book, you should buy Doug's.
I think I still know what we're talking about. Basically, Doug Copeland's a bit of a cat and Tiffany Dark's written the book on it. Tiffany, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll shortly be climbing onto the Monocle Weekly Tandem, which Tom and I ride in and out of the suburbs to Studio One upon each and every Sunday.
But before we do that, and I am looking forward to it, Rob.
Yeah. Are you going to be front or back?
I don't know.
Okay. Didn't like that question.
But before we do that, Rob, let's hear a chat about the outfits that some of our best loved cyclists don for their more substantial journeys, races, I don't know, like the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, to name but two.
Cycling Jerseys, Iconic Designs and the Stories That Made Them is a new book by cycling journalist Chris Sidwells, with a foreword by broadcaster Matt Barbette, the latter a familiar voice to Monocle 24 listeners. And a little earlier, Tom spoke to Chris and Matt about the book.
Chris Sidwells, thanks for being with us on the Monocle Weekly. It's great to have you on the programme, and it's great to have a copy, a beautiful copy of Cycling Jerseys, Iconic Designs and the Stories That Made Them in front of me, because it's a thing of beauty. And I guess that's my first question to you, really. The jerseys are beautiful items, and they convey an aesthetic, but often they convey a wider story. What was it that prompted you to do this book? Was it the fact that you wanted to tell some of those stories and share them with a wider public, maybe than just the cycling aficionado?
I think all cyclists acknowledge that the jerseys look stylish. You know, it's one of the colourful things that that brings us into the sport. But there are stories behind all of them, and the stories have helped shape what the jerseys look like. And like I said in the book, it's not just that they look good. The stories, the people who won races in them, how they were designed, help make them what they were, what they are.
Indeed. And also here alongside me is Matt Barbette, late of this parish, of course, yeah, on Monocle 24, author of the foreword and a bit of a face of cycling, I guess, here in the UK. Tell me, Matt, what jerseys mean to you? Because you there's some lovely anecdotes in your foreword, and you talk about the stories that are sort of woven into the very fabric of the jerseys. What does a great jersey mean to you, do you think?
Well, I think, and I'm sure Chris will agree with this, the jerseys fit into the larger picture of appreciating the aesthetic of cycling. So the jerseys, in some ways, are the cherry on the icing on the cake. And the icing on the cake is not just the picture of suffering you see on the cyclists' faces, but just the way they look, from the shaved legs to the beauty, the sort of perfect beauty of the two triangles of a bicycle frame, to the setting that they often race in, you know, and I guess the Alps and the Pyrenees are the pinnacle of that. So the cycling jersey and the colours and the look and the cut is all part of that look of cycling as a whole. But being more specific, it's the meaning of the jerseys that sort of takes precedence over other sporting apparel, really. Of course, jerseys are important in football and rugby and myriad other sports. But the fact is that there are so many jerseys in cycling that have to be won and then have to be worn with pride for a certain length of time, a year, usually if you're the world champion or the national champion. They're just sort of not only imbued with, you know, aesthetic design, but also meaning and importance and hierarchy. And I just think, more than any other sport, that what the protagonists wear is important in cycling.
And Chris, that's an interesting point. And we'll talk more about some of the specific jerseys in a minute. But on that point that Matt made about the meaning that's within all of these jerseys, is there a risk, you know, certainly in the last, three, four decades at least, that they become more a billboard for a sponsor, as the technologies become more advanced, that we maybe lose some of those nuances. Because when they were, I mean, I've opened the book almost at random, and there's a beautiful Azzurri national team jersey from, I guess, probably the 50s. So simple, but and yet so it conveys with such clarity what it is. Do we risk losing some of that as technologies and as all these commercial demands become ever more present in the sport?
Yes, I think you've picked a good example there. That's the Italian national team jersey. And the plain Azzurri blue was a fantastic-looking thing with different interests, and as is necessary, you know, cyclists need to earn money. It's important, as all sportsmen do. But business interests have meant that names have gone onto national jerseys, the design's been changed to reflect different things, and in some cases, a little bit of the purity lost.
And Chris, on that point, I mean, obviously the book, I guess it's sort of broadly chronological, isn't it, with a few really interesting meanders along the way. Did you ever wonder whether there was another way to tell the story on other thematics, or is it so much about charting the history of technologies, or, you know, the advent of the commercial, the brand endorsements, this sort of thing? Was that always the way you wanted to tell the story?
Yeah, I think as well, I didn't just want to hold the jersey up as a piece of art and hark back to another age, you know, which maybe held more interest. I wanted to tell the story of the jersey and, you know, make it beautiful, but tell how sponsors have changed, how design's changed, and how it's become a functional piece of kit now. You know, it's a modern clothing adds to the aerodynamics, adds to the speed of cycling.
Can I just pick up on the branding point? What I find really interesting about cycling is that initially brands put their name on jerseys to obviously get known, and the cyclists are like human billboards and this kind of thing. But the funny thing with that is, if you don't know what the brand is, you're not going to find out by seeing it on the jersey of a cyclist. So there are plenty of teams that I've supported, and I really had no idea what the brands represented. Lamprey, for example, a big Italian team, just folded, I should say. But Lamprey is a sheet steel manufacturer. I had no idea. It doesn't matter.
Won't be changing your sheet steel orders from here on in.
I'm not going to. And another one is Quickstep, which is a Belgian flooring maker. Doesn't matter really to me, because, you know, as far as I know, I'm not in the market for flooring anytime soon.
For now.
I mean, think brands like Sky, of course, I know what they are, but elsewhere in the world, just the word Sky, Team Sky, there's a sort of formidability about that. And they're perhaps in places where people can't even subscribe to Sky TV. So it's funny that I think the sport sort of changes perception of brands, even if you don't know what they're trying to sell you.
And Chris, on that point about how the messages are mixed between the sponsor's name, the design of the shirt, and of course the wearer of the jersey, do you have any particular favourites? I know it's hard to choose, but again, I've opened through to the 67 to 74 section and the BIC jersey that I'm sure lots of cycling fans will know what I mean. And there's a lovely picture of Jacques Anquetil wearing said jersey, and there's Raymond Poulidor is there. This is sort of, I think, late 60s Tour de France. Is there an era for you that when it was at its peak, when it was the perfect balance of aesthetic and athletic and brand? Did you have a favourite?
Yeah, I think the simpler designs of the 60s, and it was a time, you know, I was born in 1960, and I had a strange childhood, and I was introduced to cycling, continental cycling, earlier, because my uncle was the 1965 world champion, Tom Simpson. So I grew up looking at those pictures, and to me, you know, a picture of Jacques Anquetil in whatever jersey he wore was otherworldly. The same with Felice Gimondi in his Salvarani jersey. But also I liked Salvarani because it said something about Italy in the 60s and its engineering and its design. There's something very Italian 60s design about the Salvarani logo as well.
Chris, was it Anquetil who kept a comb in his back pocket? Was he the one who was always combing his hair in preparation, because he knew that the look was all important?
Yeah, he kept a comb in his back pocket. He sort of went against a little bit the Spartan way of a cyclist. He would even have, rather than a bag of food with glucose and stuff in it, he'd have an omelette served on longer stages. And I believe from some of his domestics, he liked a glass of Chablis mid-race as well.
Sounds a bit like your rider, Matt, that I can remember.
I often stop for glasses of fine wine on the way around, yeah.
Chris, let me ask you a bit more about Tom Simpson, of course, the late, great Tom Simpson. And there's another one of my favourites, which I picked out, which is the black and white Peugeot BP Michelin team from, I guess, yeah, this heyday, early 60s to mid-70s. And a lovely picture of Tom in his tracksuit, of course, before the 66 tour. We talk about the sort of the romance of cycling, the romance of the Grand Tours, and these extraordinary characters whose legacy is still felt to this day. Again, going back to that point about the increasing sort of commercialisation of sport, do you worry that the era of those kinds of characters is over? Because I guess for one reason or another, some of the biggest characters in the last couple of decades have maybe been for the wrong reasons, without mentioning names. Is that something that all sports have to contend with, or do you think that there are still the characters now who could dominate in the way that people like Tom Simpson or Anquetil or Poulidor and the likes of them did back a few decades ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people who are dominant, like Chris Froome in stage races, but there is a distance now from the fans, between the top cyclists and the fans, which maybe people feel it's necessary because of security, because the sport's bigger. Cycling's always been very accessible. You would get the likes of Tom and Jacques Anquetil at the start of a Tour de France stage, and people could, they'd sit on the bonnet of the car and people could come up and talk to them. So it has changed, but I think it's possibly a victim of his own success.
I'd concur with that, and I've seen it in the short time that I've been covering the sport of cycling, and that basically a lot of the guys at the top end are millionaires. They're not multi-millionaires like footballers are, but if you're a millionaire and you've got your life outside of cycling is one of sort of comfort, interspersed with periods of suffering in terms of the training and racing, you don't want to necessarily mix it with the hoi polloi. If with Chris's uncle Tom Simpson and the like, they weren't millionaires. They weren't lauded for that reason. But I agree. It's a shame that element of the sport is being eroded, because that is part of the beauty of it, the accessibility of it, and the fact. And I know the sport is struggling this, because of course they need to monetize what they do to keep it going. But you can just turn up to a roadside and watch the greatest riders in the world go right past you. And you can't do that with football or cricket or any other, you know, sport. And they would like you to pay to watch the length of the Tour de France. But luckily, they can't put barriers up for 3,500 kilometres.
Chris, can I just ask you about the way that this trickles down to, you know, your I don't know, club cyclist or just your kind of weekend road warrior? Because it is interesting, you know, I now see around me in sort of northeast London every weekend, all the guys in the latest kit, they look like they're a pro team, but then you watch them in action and they're decidedly not. And some of these guys, who, you know, that expression is like all the gear, no idea, which is a bit mean, but sometimes accurate. Do you find it entertaining to see how technology or styles or behaviours even that these great cyclists and some of our favourite jerseys, when they filter down to your, you know, man pedalling down the street?
Yeah, I mean, you can see some sights. I think actually it's lovely irony to see an overweight guy riding uphill in a polka dot jersey of the King of the Mountains. But I think that's actually quite self-aware as well. You know, it's a bit ironic. But I just think it's part of the fun of it, isn't it? This isn't something we're doing because we have to do it. It's not work. It wants to be different. And if people want to indulge themselves and, you know, wear the jersey of the rider they admire and the teams that they admire, then it's all part of it. And good luck to them.
Matt, you must, yeah, I think, because you see this quite often, yeah, when you're sort of out on the cycling circuit, and I know you also cover in other broadcasts sort of stuff about, you know, the commercial side of the sport. It must be amazing to you to watch the way that the lay fan engages with this technology and with these shirts. And that some of the, I've seen a few of those Pyman polka dot jersey wearers that Chris was wearing and knocking around.
Yeah, it's where it takes all sorts, you know, in every sport. Funnily enough, a brand does spring to mind that's called Fat Lad at the Back, and they market themselves as being the larger jersey for the guy who doesn't take himself too seriously and is not going to power up alpine climbs anytime soon. On the other hand, and we're talking about, you know, the golden era of jerseys, but it's all to do with perception and where you're sitting. For some people, that, you know, because they grew up with it, the golden era was the 80s and 90s, and you know, if you're trying to be objective about it, some of those are the busiest, ugliest designs or lacking design in terms of jerseys. I think it's gone full circle, and I think, and we've talked about it before, but I think the brand Rafa has driven the idea of cleaning up the aesthetic of cycling jerseys. Mm. They've had their followers, of course, which is flattering for them, but they've taken it full circle to go back to the clean, concise designs that we've seen in those sort of early brilliant examples. And when they picked up the design of Team Sky's jersey, which they no longer sponsor, the rest of the peloton almost followed suit. And if you look now at the World Tour peloton, on the whole, the designs of the jerseys remains fairly clean, concise, simple. I think they're perhaps on the cusp of going a bit more ugly. There's a few sort of sponsors who sneaked onto sleeves in a gaudy way, or there's certainly one of the teams at the moment has gone for a bit of an ombre look where the shorts sort of merge into the jersey. I think it's Astana have gone for that this year, which is a bit of a shame. But on the whole, I think the era, the sort of 90s, early 2000s era of gaudy jerseys like, you know, 7-Eleven and you know, and others is past us for the time being.
Chris, maybe a last word to you then. What does the future hold? Because, you know, if you look back at some of the more offbeat, you know, and notable jerseys, that Mondrian influence one was always one that jumps out at me.
Like V-Claire,
yeah. Is that where we're going to end up with, you know, basically modern art on the jerseys? Are they going to get ever more high tech? What do you think the next few years hold as you cast your critical eye forward?
I think they're going to have simple designs, because the simple designs, now the jerseys are doing a job of work, you know, not just carrying a billboard, they're actually improving the aerodynamics of the rider. It necessarily will lend itself to simpler designs. I've got a tip for the weekend cyclist, though, as well. You know, this question of style and looking good, some people do quite the opposite, but my guide is, think Fabian Cancellara. And if you're thinking of buying something and wear something, just say to yourself, would Fabian go out in this?
Yeah.
Very sage advice, I think, Chris. The book is Cycling Jerseys, Iconic Designs and the Stories That Made Them. It's a beautiful thing. Chris Sidwell's the author. Thank you for being with us. The foreword writer, you, Matt Barbette, thanks for joining us in the studio as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There we have it, Tom. Edition 399 of the Monocle Weekly. I loved it.
Almost the big 400 up.
I know. What are we going to do for that?
I don't know.
Are you going to be in training?
I will be keeping myself limber, yeah. Trying to be lissom.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Get some stretches going.
Maybe we can, I don't know, make Henry Rhys Sheridan do something.
Should we have some gin on next week's show?
That's a good way.
Used to be the kind of thing when we were feeling a little bit like we needed a bit of a pick-me-up. We'd get some gin involved.
I'm more than up for that.
Normally the way. I really enjoyed our guest today. Tiffany Dark, possibly particularly because, as you said, as we prefaced at the beginning of that conversation, we're kind of in that catchment zone, aren't we?
We are.
We probably both read that novel when we were of that impressionable age.
I'm relaxed about it, though, Rob. Yeah, are you? A lot I'm of people, sure. Some of my contemporaries, they're kind of uneasy about the, I don't know what you'd call it, the passage of time.
Yeah, I'm down with
it. It's water off a duck's back to me.
I'm quite enjoying it. I don't know if I'm getting better, but I'm caring less that I'm worse.
That's very true. Right? I'm fully on board with that.
So anyway, way to go.
That's exactly the kind of note we should strike at the end of end of a show.
That's all right, isn't it? Let's thank our pals behind the glass, shall we? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Stephen Kenny. Our studio managers were Claire Urban and Wai Dong Lin. The Monocle Week will be back at same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.